reach the Outrider Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to episode 13 of the Outrider Podcast. I'm Jason Quinn Millott. You know, I always think I'm going to Mark Maron this thing and just go on and ramble constructively for a good 10 minutes and entertain you, but it never quite works out that way, and I fail at it. So I'm going to get right to the short and sweet of it. My guest on the show today is Timothy Shaffert. He is the author of a brand new book out from Riverhead Penguin. It's called The Swan Gondola. It's out there in hardcover now, so get your hands on it. I started reading it a couple of weeks ago, and I'm thoroughly enjoying it. And let's see here. His first book was The Phantom Limbs of the Rollo Sisters. His second book was The Singing and Dancing Daughters of God. His third book, the other one of his that I've read, is Devils in the Sugar Shop. And his fourth book was The Coffins of Little Hope. And he's won a lot of awards and gotten some recognition for all of these, a Boston Globe Pick of the Week, a New York Times Book Review Editor's Choice, a Nebraska Book Award, you know, all sorts of nifty stuff like that, and lots of blurbs and glowing reviews. So he's definitely worth your time if you want to go out and pick up that book, and I recommend that you do. I had a chance to talk to Timothy in person, which is very, very rare. So rare, in fact, that this was only my second time recording a live. No, my third. Wow, things I forget. My third one recording a live podcast, and my first one though with a two mic setup. And the one thing that I was afraid I would not get right, I sort of didn't get right. So when you're listening to the show, you're going to hear me in one ear, and you're going to hear Timothy in both ears. And it didn't sound like that when I was testing everything at home the night before, but I guess the composite setup mic thing doesn't really like to transfer well, and I clicked something odd when I was nervous and setting up in the hotel room. So one of the drawbacks of learning by doing rears its ugly head again. So be patient with me, and let's go listen to this conversation with Timothy Shaffert.
This is what happens when you decide you're going to learn by doing.
Right. That's right.
Everything kind of goes a little left for a little while. I just want to, yeah, I think we're going
there. All right. Sound good?
I think so. We'll see. We'll see. make sure I've got. Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. Real professional operation here. Okay. Timothy Shaffert. Welcome to Wichita.
Yes. Thank you so much.
You would think Penguin would afford a bigger hotel room. <Right. laughs> Well, I don't know if you've had a chance to ever hear any of the episodes that I've done before with some of the people.
I listened to Collins.
Oh, Colin. Yeah. Yeah, that was a lot of fun, although I kind of got stuck there at the end of it. But
oh, I don't remember.
Yeah, well. So I guess I'll just start. Let's start with your backstory.
Okay.
You're originally from Nebraska, correct?
Yeah, I grew up on a farm in the middle of Nebraska, basically, and went to college at the University in Lincoln. And I currently live in Omaha. I've lived in Omaha now for about 17 years.
So your parents were farmers?
Yes, and my dad had a trucking business as well. So we had 80 acres, and then. Yeah, so in the town I went to school in was Aurora, and that was a population of about 4,000 at the time.
Is that out in western Nebraska? Or?
It's like 75 miles west of Lincoln. So it's sort of central, sort of eastern. I mean, because Nebraska goes on and on further west. So
it's like western Kansas, which is where I grew up. Right, I grew up out in Dodge City.
Yeah.
Fortunately, my parents were not so productive as to have been farmers. My dad was a parole officer.
Ah.
Wanted to be a psychologist, ended up being a parole officer. So the farm, was that the whole nine yards, or was there something in particular that that you guys did?
Mostly corn. That was what we raised year after year. And I think we had cattle from time to time and some hogs. And but it was really what kept the family afloat was my dad's trucking business. Right. So
how did you end up being involved with literature? Because that's kind of you don't hear many writers coming out from weird farm communities, in the western parts of plain states.
Yeah, I read a lot, went to the library a lot, went to bookstores, wrote as a kid, drew little picture books. I was big into comic books growing up, and so I had my own little comics that I would put together. And so, there was... my mom read a lot, so there was always books in the house, and I don't know. I mean, I always thought from the time I was a little kid that I wanted to be a writer at some point or an illustrator or something.
So there was no singular triggering moment?
Not really, no. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was when I was in college that I discovered that it was actually something that people did. I think you grow up and you like in my school, we had these textbooks that were 100 years old or something. And so the short story in particular felt like this antiquated form that I didn't think anybody really practiced anymore because the stories we were reading were so old. And then to find out in college that, to learn about literary journals and to learn that the short story form was actually thriving was enlightening. And and it was also in college that I learned about the Masters of Fine Arts programs, which are a great opportunity to while the time away and focus on your writing among other like-minded folk.
So did you originally try to major in something else before you found creative writing?
Well, I thought that it would be more practical to major in journalism, and I thought I could write, and I started in news editorial, and then I thought, well, I'll go into advertising because that felt more creative, and then I went back to news editorial, and then finally just switched to English, like my last year of college. I thought that it seemed like there was more of a career track for journalists. I mean, the idea that you could do an internship at a newspaper and just follow the path, whereas in writing, it's just, there isn't a career path. I mean, you can invest in building a career, but you're just throwing it to the wind.
Sounds a bit like what happened to me. I mean, out in western Kansas, I did not meet my first, professional published writer until I got to college. And, when I'd got out of high school, I too thought, well, I'll just go and major in journalism. And I showed up for my freshman orientation, before the semester started, is where you go and you decide what you're going to major in. You go through the catalog, set your schedule, all that stuff. And I was flipping through the catalog. I went to K-State and opened up, and they had... Somehow I ended up going to the English department, even though I had been a terrible student in English in high school, and saw that you could major in English creative writing. I've been writing short stories and stuff since, the sixth grade when a teacher handed out these worksheets. And I thought, I can do that. I said, right on. And that was my major from day one. I didn't even bother to go visit the journalism department after that. And of course, I made it through. It took me 5 years to get through college, just because I was busy, as I used to say, minoring in grain science down at Rusty's Last Chance.
Right, that's the way it goes. Well, that's part of the experience. That's part of the education. That's right. Why you get credits for that in a creative writing program, I suspect.
And especially when you come out of the sticks and all you know is the mythology about writers. Right. You have to think, like, this is what you do. You right. go into bars and you drink yourself right. into a...
Since there is no career path, then...
So... Who was teaching it at Nebraska when you were there as an undergrad?
The first class I took was with Judy Slater. She eventually published a collection called The Baby Can Sing, mm-hmm. of short stories. And she really focused on short stories. And her husband, Jerry Shapiro, was the next class I took. They were both teaching. And he was also really considered himself a short story writer. And so it was a great opportunity to study with two writers who were so focused on right. the form. And also Marley Swick was there at the time, and she, okay. You know, a phenomenal short story writer. Right. So it really felt like a unique experience in that way. Even though the program wasn't designed specifically around short fiction, here I was working with these writers who were doing and succeeding, you know, with the short form. So I took as many classes as I could, and then some right. with the three of them. But we didn't have, and we still don't. I mean, I teach now in the program where I learned, right. and we never did have a creative writing. I mean, we have a creative writing program mm-hmm. and a graduate program, but in terms of the undergraduate curriculum, we offer creative writing courses, but it's not yet. I mean, hopefully someday
it will
be. Yeah. So you kind of have to discover it on your own, I think. Yeah. Or I did, anyway. And now we have better guidance for our students. Yeah. But
yeah. No, when I started at K-State, Steve Heller was teaching there,
sure.
Who's now down at Antioch. And also Ben Nyberg, who I think his biggest claim to fame outside of writing a bunch of great short stories was writing a book for Writer's Digest called One Great Way to Write Short Stories, or One Damn
perfect.
Good Way to, something like that. And that was actually one of the textbooks for the intro to creative writing class that a guy named Gary Clift taught, who
okay.
used to run Kansas Quarterly before they sold it off to Arkansas.
Oh, okay. Yeah, those textbooks, I tell you, there's a lot of them.
Yeah, apparently that's kind of where you have to make your money, I guess, or at least part of it.
I think, well, and certainly I think if you work in academia too, it ends up being a way to kind of market yourself as a teacher as well, to have this this guidebook on your list.
Yeah. Have you thought about writing one of those?
I have.
Oh, you have?
But I have thought about it. I have not written one. it does not get much further than
right.
a concept. But I've, because sometimes you'll be teaching a class and like, oh, you know, this is useful. I think I'm onto something here.
Right.
I could get a book out of this. And that's about as far as it goes.
Yeah. I was worried about, you know, doing things like that and having it fall into being a formula.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And to me, I'm a big fan of writing as a process of discovery, rather than I'm not trying to knock people that have outlines, that make outlines,
right.
that's how their brain works. But you know, this idea that you can just plug in things into
right.
something, wow, that's disturbing. That's reminds
right.
me of that story machine in Calvino's If on a Winter's Night a Traveler,
right.
just waiting for something to fall apart and go wrong.
Yeah, and the thing is, you have students going into programs expecting that, though. You
mm-hmm.
know, they want to learn how to write fiction.
Right.
And some teachers will say, oh, okay, well, this is how you do it. And it's a way to kind of gain authority over mm-hmm. the material where you might not otherwise have it. Whereas, yeah, I think some of us see it as more mysterious, and that our role as teachers is to kind of guide the students or lead them towards their own discoveries, right, and finding their own way into the work and their own material and their own subject. But that can sometimes seem wishy-washy to students. And so it is, I think, it probably does make more sense to thrust a textbook at them and say, here it is. Yeah. Now learn this and I'll grade you.
Right. And the ones that can get through the textbook and see beyond it are the ones that really are going to end up being writers.
Yeah.
So maybe it's there as a good weeding out process.
Yeah. Yeah. There's got to be some purpose. Behind
it. We've got to find a way to justify our existence. Right.
We can't be sending these people out into the world with nothing or less than nothing.
Yeah, when I was in graduate school, there was a dust up between the poetry track and the fiction track. Mm. There was a lot of argument one summer for some reason. I don't remember why we were doing it. I just remember Brian Evanson. I was taking a week-long workshop with him, and he just kind of listened to us, you know, complain about it. The students in the class complain about the war, and he goes, you know, the problem with young, unpublished writers is that the only thing they have to justify their existence is their artistic aesthetic.
Oh, sure.
And so they defend it as if their life mattered.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And once you guys get published, it'll go away.
There's a lot to that.
It kind of did. Yeah. Like I said, so whatever the argument was, it had something to do with aesthetics, and it's now gone the way of, you know, lost memory. So,
right.
Did you go right from undergraduate to the MFA program?
I did. Wow. So I went to the University of Arizona and got an MFA there. And that was... I didn't get into any place else, and I didn't. Some of my students apply all over the place, you know, and I applied like to maybe 3-4 places, and was fortunate to get into U of A, and that was a good experience. And they probably part of the reason I got in is because they at the time let a lot of people in, so which was nice too, because then you could kind of you could develop friends,
right,
that without being forced into friendships, I guess. You could pick and choose, right, the people you wanted to share your work with, basically.
Yeah, do you feel like that was one of the most important moments of your development as a writer?
No, I think the undergraduate experience is the most important, because that was really when I figured out that I could do, you know, that mm-hmm. I figured out what it is that you're supposed to do, really, right, and that I could lean towards doing that. I mean, it was very enlightening in terms of what it meant to be a writer, mm-hmm, in what was then the 20th century, the late 20th century. And so I developed a lot in working with those teachers that I mentioned, and we just reading everything I could get my hands on,
right,
and so and picking up what I could from that work and from the great literature and from the and learning more about contemporary fiction of the time. And and so that was really when I was playing with different things and finding my way and finding, mm-hmm, my voice. And and I'm not sure what graduate school did for me exactly, except, you know, it was I mean, I'm glad I did it, and it was, right, a great experience, but I'm not sure that it really necessarily facilitated my direction.
Right.
If a direction can be facilitated.
Yeah, that was, I think for me though, graduate school was the moment that, because undergraduate was fine. I mean, there were good teachers there, Steve Heller, Gary Clift, and stuff like that. But they kept changing the course number on Steve Heller's creative writing workshop.
Oh.
And because they changed its numbering level, I took it more times than I should have been able to.
Right.
And the last time I took it, he was kind of fed up with me. And he kind of paid me one of those roundabout backhanded compliments. He goes, you know, your one strength as a writer is you're stubborn. he goes, you know, you'll write something, it'll come into class, people will tear it apart, and you'll go back and revise it and come back and amp up those parts that people don't like. And they'll just say, do you see what I'm trying to do now? And, you know, which was kind of like, you know, maybe you should have gone into journalism type of compliment. I don't know.
Well, that's what I remember about graduate school, too, is that I went from the undergraduate experience, which was really about bringing your work into the workshop and looking at it and saying, okay, well, this is what the story is doing now.
Right.
Here's what the story could be doing, or here's what I think you want the story to do. And so it was really like, you know, Eudora Welty, I think, said once something about with each story you learn how to write a short story. Each story has its own demands and requirements. And I really kind of felt like that was the philosophy that we were going with in my undergraduate. And in graduate school, it was more of the, oh, well, this is what's expected. This is what fiction is today. You have to have this. You have to have that. I mean, it wasn't necessarily expressed that explicitly, but that was what I was coming away from with from the workshops was, oh, they have a very specific idea of what they want their students writing.
They've got a formula for literary fiction.
Yeah, right? they wouldn't dare to necessarily say that, I don't think, but that's the example that's what your work was being held up against. And so I had a similar feeling as you're mentioning of finding out what it is that they wanted from the story and trying to do the exact opposite, as if I was going to prove to them.
You know, doing what I wanted to have the story do.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think maybe that's why graduate school was a big explosive release for me, because I took 4 years between undergrad and graduate school. Lived in my mother's basement here in Wichita and worked retail and was just having a miserable time. And finally read David Gutterson's Snow Falling on Cedars.
Oh, sure.
And there's this scene where Ishmael and Hatsu are in the tree before she gets taken off to the internment camp. Mm. And, you know, it's got this weird sexual tension in it, but it's incredibly emotional. And I remember reading that, and I, you know, kind of had my little tear-up cry moment in a story. And it was like suddenly the little light went off in my head, and it was, that's what I wanted to do. That's what they beat out of me as an undergrad. And so I spent half of the $300 I had to my name at that time on a typewriter and went off to graduate school. But I went to Naropa.
Oh, right.
And that was, I think, you know, just the influence of that, you know, Waldman and Ginsberg's ghost that hovers over everything up there is just like, you know, experiment, play, do whatever, and got introduced to Michael Ondaatje, who had a huge influence on where I went.
And yeah.
So yeah, that was my moment where it's just
that makes sense. Everything. Yeah.
who are some of your writer influences, the ones that you haven't met but who have had a significant role in your development?
You know, it's always hard to pin down because there's, you know, I feel like so much of what's in my head is influenced by things even that I don't necessarily want it to be influenced by, you know. So all the, you know, terrible television you watch growing up and all the soap operas and so that you just find your brain kind of thinking that's what a plot is or something, you know. And so I feel like a lot of times I'm taking what has been this kind of chaos of references and influences and applying my own voice, I guess, or finding it, sort of filtering it through my own perspective when I'm trying to get it all, when I'm trying to tell a story and get it all down on the page. But I certainly have, I keep returning to the stories of Eudora Welty, know. I love her language and her sense of humor and the kind of the wit and pathos that she brings, and yet in this kind of dry and eloquent delivery, and Faulkner, I guess I would have to credit Faulkner a lot with helping me to understand I understand language and point of view and right. and all the things he was playing with in his fiction, and partly because I had no idea what was going on when I first picked up a book by Faulkner,
right,
and so
right.
I just kept rereading it, you know. And Virginia Woolf is a writer I go back to a lot. I loved Larry McMurtry
right.
when I was in high school and college. And,
when did you first discover Welty?
That would have been in college.
Okay.
So I assume some of I or maybe I might have read Why I Live at the P.O. in high school. Mm-hmm. I think in high school a lot of people read that. Huh. And she was at the time widely anthologized, I
yeah.
think.
And
I think that's, and then just read all of her work.
Right.
You know.
Did you feel like there were gaps in your reading that you're still trying to fill?
Oh yeah, there's huge gaps. I mean, there's all kinds of yeah. stuff I feel like I should have read by now and want to read.
I think there's I hear people talk about Welty a lot, and she's one that I have not read much of anything by. And part of it was because it was never, you know, pushed on me in school. And I always hear people rave about her, and I
yeah.
haven't. And I think I got to put that on the list. I got to put it on the list. But I have no idea where to start.
Yeah, the thing is, this book that I just wrote has this has a kind of shadow across it of The Wizard of Oz, and mm-hmm. so there's certain references and quotes and you know and but it's in no way a literal retelling or
right.
even it's not even necessarily a revision, but it's something that was in my mind, and I kind of didn't realize it at the time, but I came to realize that this was a similar approach that Eudora Welty took to her story Sir Rabbit, which has all kinds of echoes of Alice in Wonderland, but is actually a very dark and creepy story, which we don't really think of Eudora Welty as writing
right.
dark and creepy stories, but she did. I mean, there was that, you know, we think of her as the proper Southern lady, but but there was a very rich imagination and a very kind of there's a chaotic quality to the interaction of the characters
right.
in her work.
So where should I start with Eudora Welty?
I love Why I Live at the P.O. or the collected stories, you can't go wrong. You just open
okay.
them up and she's the one. The Wide Net is a terrific
right.
story. Sir Rabbit that I mentioned, Old Mr. Marblehall is fun. So, and she's also very playful with point of view. And that's something that's interested me through the years because I feel like I don't yet even understand it. You know, we all know the textbook definition and
right.
requirements of point of view, but it's, to me, it's an incredibly mysterious aspect of fiction writing that, I'm always wanting to take a step further with.
So what made you go back to Nebraska after graduate school?
I lived in New York for a very short time, and then just kind of went broke and moved back to the farm
right.
to gather my wits and with all intentions of moving someplace else again, but then
right.
I didn't. So
I know that feeling.
Yeah.
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 I was quite happy in Boulder, and then I lost my job. Well, I didn't lose it. They fired me for insubordination.
Imagine.
And it was like a month and a half before the end of my lease on my apartment, and my roommate and I had already decided we were going to find different places, so I just came back here, and I've been here now for 9 years.
Right, right,
and,
right.
Oh, I keep trying to get out of this place, and it keeps sucking me.
That's right.
It's like the mob or Ginsburg's vortex that it was, right. You know, it's...
But, you know, it ends at, like, living in Nebraska is affordable, and for a long time, I hardly worked at all. I mean, I did freelancing, so I had some good freelancing contracts, and so in those, when I was writing those first novels, I would be able to focus several weeks at a time on them in between projects. So, I mean, you could live on next to nothing, really. Get a cheap apartment, don't eat, don't go out, and just stay in and write. That's what I tell young writers, aspiring writers, to do. Don't eat.
That might have been some advice I should have gotten about, you know, 20 years ago. That and don't go to a private school for graduate school. You know? I guess I've talked to some other Naropa people, and we look at the amount of student loans we came away with, and we're like going, yeah, that was a mistake, but it was the right mistake. You know?
Yeah, right. It was Naropa.
I wouldn't trade in the experience. I'd trade in the loans in a heartbeat.
Right. And plus, you gotta go with your heart and soul when it's telling you what to do.
Yeah. The only problem is when your heart and soul tells you to run.
Yeah.
You can't. So.
Oh. Well, that's a whole other problem.
That's a whole other problem. Yeah. I don't know. Now, I've been wanting to talk to you about the Omaha Literary Festival, the thing that you're involved with. Did you help start that?
I did. I just I wanted to get some writers together and to talk about issues of primarily fiction and writing and readership and a kind of informal environment for readers and writers to meet and discuss. I had some ideas for panel discussions, things that I thought would be not just interesting to hear, but interesting to kind of promote and to get word out about, and to, you know, because it's fun sometimes just to try to define trends and to try to look and see what is going on in contemporary fiction and get smart people together to come up with theories and notions and I kind of wanted to get to have these events in bars and theaters and kind of get them out of the college classroom, basically. Right. And so that was kind of the inspiration. So I just thought, well, I'll see if I can find some space, and I'll see if I can get some writers to come. And sure enough, it worked that first year. And so and it didn't cost very much money, and so I've done it this next in September. It'll be the 10th time we've done it, and
that's cool, because I would love to hear what was the, let me get all my thoughts in order, because I'm so excited about this. What was the literary scene like in Omaha before you started this, and what is it now 10 years later, 10 events later?
Well, it's about the same, I think. it's Omaha is in no way the heart of contemporary fiction. I mean, it's we have great writers there, and we get together from time to time at things like the Lit Fest to talk about things of common interest. But really, I think the Lit Fest has been about readers and writers finding readers and readers finding writers, and again, like having that kind of informal gathering where it's not like, we don't do a lot of literary readings at the Lit Fest. Right. Sometimes we do, but usually it's conversation, and so it's usually an opportunity for people to ask questions that's on their mind and just to do like we're doing, you know, just have conversation. And so we have writers from the Omaha and Lincoln area come in, but we also, like that first year that I did it, I wanted to invite writers who don't live in Omaha but still have some kind of sentimental attachment to Nebraska. And so, like, Kurt Anderson came back for that, and Michael Ripps and Megan Daum. And so that's been part of the notion, you know, part of the philosophy behind the event is to bring people back, and then also people that I meet along the way, and so it's we come up with a theme, you know, and sometimes that's based on what I've read the previous year or what I think is going on that's interesting. Like, one year we focused on the Vita count and the discrepancy between in the publishing industry or in magazines specifically between the number of men published in literary magazines and the number of women and the number of men reviewed versus the number of women. And so we had a lot of conversations about that one year. So it's fun to come up with those themes and to play with them. But it's all, like, I call it a festival, but it is so not a festival. I mean, it's, there's some festivals that attract thousands and thousands of people. And this event's a little eclectic, you know, or a little prickly or something, I guess. And so, you know, to be fairly devoted to my own perverse sense of subject matter, I guess.
So how did you go about recruiting venues to host the things?
Well, that first year I just went around and asked. I mean, I had worked for an alternative weekly probably 5 years before that. And so I knew some of these people. And I also thought that it would be helpful if we did it with the intentions of raising money for somebody. So and I talked to the director of the library at the time, Rivka Sass, and she was excited about it. And so that helped too. I mean, when you're able to sort of step forward and say, this is to promote the library and to raise funds for whatever particular project we were raising funds for. And so it had a kind of charitable aspect as well that made people want to get on board. We had a lot of different venues those first couple of years, and that was a ton of work, just balancing all of that and getting people to commit and without uncommitting and getting them to commit in time that it would I'd be able to promote it and all of that. So now I do the lazy thing. We just have it at the library. And so I've gone from wanting to take it out of an institutional setting to putting it right back in.
Yeah, you do a multi-day event. I mean, it's a multi-day.
We have a Friday night party and then Saturday afternoon discussions. Okay. So just a couple of, and the Friday night party attracts quite a few people, and then the discussions can, you know, anywhere from 30 to 50 people per panel discussion. Right. So
because I'd love to have something like that around here.
Oh yeah, yeah.
The literary scene here is isolated and fractured, and I don't know how the university interacts with the public in Lincoln and Omaha. But here, the MFA program is very insular.
Oh, okay.
And it's because they've got four people. They don't have a support staff at all.
Yeah.
They don't have a lot of funding. And so they just focus on teaching their students.
And
Goldbarth and everybody, they don't get out and really engage with the public.
Right.
And they don't have an outreach program for their students.
Oh, sure.
And you know, that was one of the great experiences when I was in graduate school was Naropa had their project outreach and got us, you know, taught us how to write proposals and design classes and then go out in the public and, you know, find people that were willing to take those classes with us. So I taught a workshop at a senior center and the YMCA to high school students, which we'll roundabout. I'll get a whole bunch of stuff, which is kind of my thing. I like to ask when I'm getting to it and it's itching. But here, you know, so the university doesn't really engage much. And we've got two other universities that have English departments with writers at them, Friends University and Newman. And even Butler Community College has a couple of published writers on staff there, John Jenkinson. And then outside of the university, we've got the Kansas Writers Association and the Kansas Authors Club, and they're very – this is going to be rude. And amateur is not a bad word,
sure.
But everybody seemed to have a negative connotation. Those two groups are very amateurish.
Sure.
They've got a couple of writers that are associated with them that have been, you know, published with decent, you know, I guess they call them legacy presses,
okay.
Like the ones we
get. Oh, I see. Okay.
Rather than self-publishing, but most of the people in their groups, you know, are self-publishing.
Right.
And I don't know how well they're self-publishing.
Right,
you know,
right.
One of those things where it's just like they finish up a manuscript, nobody reads it, revises it, edits it, right. Whatever, and they just throw it out.
There's all kinds of varieties of that.
And the KWA has a one-day, you know, marathon seminar type of thing. And I went to one last year covering it for our alternative weekly.
Oh, okay.
And there were and Jenna Blum came and spoke at it.
Sure.
And disappeared right away. John Jenkinson hung around and did it. And these are the two people that I really got something from what they had to say. The two newspaper reporters were shockingly naive about the publishing industry.
Oh, okay.
Even though they both have books published that have been out in the world. One of them was telling us how he had had an agent in Kansas City and they'd been paying him all this money and he wasn't doing anything. And
oh, I thought, dear. Yeah,
you don't need to talk to these people. They're naive enough already.
Right. Right.
And they don't really do a lot of advertising and publishing and engaging and in the way that I kind of learned how to do it.
Sure.
And so I'm interested in how do I get that started, because I'm also trying to juggle, you know, full-time job and writing and all this other stuff. And which gets me to the point, you know, we as literary writers, you know, the NEA comes out with that study where they keep showing that, you know, the adult rates of reading literature of an actual work of fiction is declining.
Oh.
We're back to 2002 levels.
Yeah, whatever.
You know, and it keeps dropping. And
thank God they traced that for us. So
yeah, they make us all paranoid and feel
so
bad.
That's such useful information.
Right? But my curiosity about it all is there is. I do think there is kind of a decline of interest in literature. People are able to get entertainment from a lot of other places, and not all of it's really better.
Right.
So what should we be doing? Because our livelihood, our vocation depends upon an audience.
Yeah.
So, and it kind of requires us to be interested in how we build and maintain and grow that audience if we want to, or do we want to just give up and, you know, take our university appointments if we have them or whatever and continue to fight over this shrinking percentage of readers? What can we do to engage the public and get them interested in reading again?
Yeah, and I think part of what I was hoping to accomplish and what I hope I have accomplished with the Lit Fest was to try to tap into other communities in the city. And so there's usually a visual art component. So we'll have an art exhibit. We've had graphic design exhibits. And we've incorporated music elements through the years and such. So, and again, like, going into various venues where there aren't typically literary events, and just trying to get word out into other communities that will get word out within their community here's this book that might be of interest to you, or have you thought about instead of doing this thing, maybe doing that thing. And so so part of it is just trying to, I mean, it just sometimes it can feel, the whole pursuit can just feel kind of frumpy, you know, and, mm-hmm. And so the idea is to take those works that you think are really inspiring and, you know, the writers are doing all the right stuff or whatever, you know, whatever that you personally find exciting about contemporary writing and coming up with an excuse to bring attention right. to it, you know? So, and that's another thing that's been fun too. I mean, even when I was working at the Alternative, you know, you'd write the article and part of the pleasure was seeing what the designers did with it on the mm-hmm. page and seeing what kind of cover they came up with. And that's been part of the interesting thing about the Lit Fest too, and the art component, you know, and seeing what different artists and different designers, how they relate to the work that we put before them. And so I think it's just a matter of being innovative and figuring out ways to kind of immerse ourselves right. in the places where the people are. And, right. But it's, yeah, I mean, it, and I guess I feel more optimistic than those surveys. And I'm skeptical about their reliability. Yeah. I mean, cause I think that a lot of writers are finding a lot of readers. It's just, I think there's so much out there now right. that it's becoming more and more difficult to find your ideal readership and mm-hmm. to find the people who are looking for work like you're writing. And so right. I think that's the predicament that the writer's in is having all the support that you need in order to develop that readership. Yeah. Because I think that it exists and it literally exists for a lot of writers,
right.
A lot of good writers who do develop a following and are able to, you know, and to have their work lean towards the iconographic, I guess, and right. to for their characters to kind of step beyond the realm of literary fiction and into the mainstream culture.
Right. And I'm giving a presentation about that question in April.
Okay.
The Wichita Art Museum does every month they do art chatter.
Oh, nice.
Which is, I don't remember, it's taken from some Japanese form. You get 20 slides for 20 seconds each. And you get
sure.
for that. So it's like a little 7-minute.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you just go with it. So I'm kind of giving my real abbreviated answer to that question. Mm-hmm. For the presentation, which the one thing I'm worried about is it takes a lot more backstory to explain my answer than what I'm.
That's so often the case.
That's why I write novels.
That's right, so exactly.
But I've always thought I stumbled. Well, when I was doing my preliminary reading that led to the first novel, I read Sarajevo, Exodus of a City by David right. Karazhan, and he has that really moving section in there, Literature and War, where he talks about the writer's culpability for the civil war in Bosnia.
Oh, okay.
And how their obsession with entertainment for entertainment's sake, or what he called art for art's sake, where it's separated from the social connection. It doesn't right. mean anything. It's just empty thrill.
Yeah.
And how that opens the door for what he called heroic fiction or dogmatic fiction, mm-hmm. where you've got someone who has an ideology they're trying to push.
Okay.
And after people have been numbed by art for art's sake, they embrace the ideological okay. fiction sure. because it gives them meaning and connection and whatever.
Right.
And that enables them to convince other people that they should commit these atrocities to support that ideology.
Right.
You know, it's kind of the explanation as to why Ayn Rand is so important right now to the right.
Right.
He also goes on about what makes good literature, and it falls in line with what John Gardner wrote about in On Moral Fiction.
Oh, sure.
and there's a lot of tie-in for me is also with Joseph Campbell.
Oh yeah,
and stuff like that, and how we're in this gap between effective mythologies. Our old agrarian religions have become dogmatic and rigid and literal, and so they don't have that metaphorical significance and punch that they used to have.
Right.
And so we're in the process of, he suggests, of creating new ones. And to me, that's where we live as writers.
That transition.
The myth makers.
Yeah.
And so it becomes important for us to figure out how to engage with the public, how to confront morally questionable literature.
Right.
Without also becoming dogmatic and didactic ourselves.
Right.
So.
Yeah, I mean, that's on our minds when we're approaching our work. And,
right.
You know, like in terms of thinking about, I mean, if you have an ideal reader and like and what shape you want your work to take and what place you want it to fall into, and then you have the whole business aspect. And okay, let's say I have this expression, how interested is anybody going to be in helping me to reach that readership? And so it's not just talking about commercial fiction, but I mean, even a nonprofit publisher is still focused on finding readers. I mean, it's not, unless it's a micro press of one editor who simply publishes the work that he or she deems worthy. Storytelling implies a listener, and as a writer, you're kind of trying to gauge, how far you think this expression can reach out, and how useful, I guess, it'll be to the people that read it. And but that ends up being a kind of moral quandary or philosophical issue that you end up puzzling over to distract you from the fact that you're blocked or something. I think sometimes. It's very interesting to think about, but then there's the reality of the process for me in writing is like, it's so foreign to any of that. You know, I'm not literally thinking about the readership when I'm writing a book. I'm thinking about communicating,
right.
and I want my sentences to make sense. I want there to be clarity, but you as a writer wanting to slip into that world of your imagination and let the characters do what they need to do and say what they need to say and working towards these themes that are sort of in your subconscious, and you're letting that subconscious guide you and hoping that that subconscious is guiding you in a way that's going to be meaningful to the readers.
Out of your personal obsessions, the things obsessed with
your subject,
philosophical
your
existential level.
Your themes, your subjects, your material.
That's why I love this podcast and this chance, because for years I used to complain to Rebecca, my ex-girlfriend, that there weren't any writers to talk to around here.
Yeah.
You know, I started listening to podcasts, you know, Mark Maron's WTF and stuff like that. I thought, I'll just start talking to him.
Right.
And, you know, I love having conversations like this. So thanks for letting me invade your hotel space. Here
absolutely.
And
my pleasure.
We've got about a little while before you head off to the store for the event, so I'm going to let you collect yourself.
All right. Thank you so much.
And I'll see you at Watermark, and where you'll be reading from the Swan Gondola tonight.
I will.
Because I just started it.
Yes.
I'm behind on everything. I've been distracted for weeks.
I know how that goes.
But very cool. Thanks, Timothy.
Yeah, thank you.
Enjoyed it.
All right, that was my conversation with Timothy Shaffert. I hope you all enjoyed it. Be back in 2 weeks where I will have my episode 14, my conversation with romance writer Teresa Romaine. All right, it'll be fun. I'll see you in a couple of weeks.